Well, let me try my part.
Okay.
This is a session with Andrew, recorded on August 13th, copyright 2010, New Grandview Incorporated, all rights reserved, and we're starting at 10:24 p.m. Hawaii time. It is August 14th in Auckland, New Zealand right now, where Andrew is. So I made my part of the copyright. You can make your part of the copyright.
Yeah, see, you got my bit all wrong. It's like Friday the 13th in your time. Yeah, 14th of August, 2010 in Auckland, New Zealand. Yep. And the theme, we're talking about conscious mediumship.
Yes, and you raised this question. You wanted to talk about it, and I've been waiting years for someone to ask me about this. So I'm ready to talk about it, and I'm hoping it leads into all kinds of stuff that we discussed when you were doing your PhD a few years ago. We had many long conversations on the phone, and a lot of good percepts came out of that, and I'd like to evoke those. Now, I don't know which ones will be, but I'm hoping that the excellence of our dialogues back then and subsequently over the last few years will be registered in this recording, or at least the beginnings of it. So I don't know where we're going to go with this, but and I don't know where, I don't think you even know where you want. So you state what evoked this question for you.
Okay, so the question has been boiling for quite some time. It came up as a result of listening through a series of audio histories that you did with a number of figures, calling Paris Flamond, Bob Carr, Gerd Stern, and a number of influential figures that you'd say, you know, countercultural, I guess you'd call them, during the 60s. And there's this recurrent theme that runs through that, this idea of, or this ideal of conscious mediumship. And in a sense, I got the feeling that it's something that McLuhan's been playing with the whole time, but he never brings it to the surface. And so I wanted to chart out this area of my ignorance and see what comes up. I guess from my own background and perspective, there's always an acknowledgement of some transcendental just over the fringe, but it's how do you talk about it? How do you think about it? And yeah, I was hoping that you could shed some light on this topic, Bob.
Okay, the other person you didn't name, important figure on the very, very margins, David Worster, David Eugene Worster, he was the one who gave me the phrase. And I met him in the late 60s. He was in Seattle, and he was channeling something called cosmic awareness. And either in an interview I read done with him around that time, or in conversations with him, I can't remember, he was talking about Krishnamurti, Jiddu Krishnamurti, not UG Krishnamurti, the Manipian satirist version of Jiddu Krishnamurti. Jiddu Krishnamurti, David got from him a sense of moving into trance was not the be-all and end-all, that the idea was to be a conscious medium. And he thought Krishnamurti represented that. And it wasn't until after Krishnamurti died in 1986, a biography or two came out, and the author was a close friend of his, and Krishnamurti once confided to her that he did go into some kind of trance state just before he would, when he was alone, just before he'd go out and speak, some kind of thing, but he never wanted to talk about it, and he didn't want to emphasize it, but there was some kind of, who knows what you call it, out of suggestion, whatever, and so he was... He touched on what's called the psychic, yet he always put that down in his talks. So I think that contradiction, Dave Worster didn't know, as far as I know, whether Krishnamurti went into trance a little bit before his talks. Maybe Dave did know it, but Dave, as a medium himself, appreciated Krishnamurti pointing to that as not the end goal of his situation. But to a kind of conscious mediumship, which is what Krishnamurti pointed to, though I don't think Krishnamurti ever said that phrase. So I got the phrase or concept from David Worster, and we took classes in the late 60s into early 1970 leading towards some kind of development, towards, I don't know, some maybe become a medium for cosmic awareness, and this was... courses laid out by cosmic awareness. Now, the interesting thing is that Dave Worster, very good student of Krishnamurti, didn't want to be a medium, but still allowed himself to have this cosmic awareness come through, which wasn't an entity, or I don't know, it was just the force of the universe, much like what Ion calls itself, an event or a non-physical event or just non-physical. So back to Worcester, it was he who made me think about it. Now, at the time, I was certainly aware of McLuhan, and he's saying the medium is the message and many other statements. But McLuhan always said he didn't have a theory of consciousness. He just dealt with percepts. So you might recall this. He says it in, I think, the Gerald Stern interview in McLuhan Hot and Cool. I don't have a theory of consciousness. And I found that very interesting because I always thought he was talking about consciousness or whatever I thought consciousness was, collective or personal, in his discursions. Also, he one or two times said that a medium creates a kind of hypnosis. So Dave Worcester used to point out that Ralph Doobie, the first channel medium expression of cosmic awareness, was hypnotized into that state. So you've got hypnosis, suggestion, Dave Worcester not for hypnosis, trying to be conscious medium. Then you have, what is the environmental meaning of medium as McLuhan lays out? Is it a collective hypnosis inside the effect of the printing press or the effect of television? So I think that was the range of parameters that I would think about as I wondered what conscious mediumship could refer to. So does that help to give you a basic framework to figure out what it is?
Yeah, it's. I guess I'm groping towards a state that I think you sometimes exhibit as well, but that McLuhan gets to when he says, I make all my discoveries when I'm talking, where McLuhan actually launches into a state of, I trust my mouth will take me into a place where I know not. And he just simply starts talking, and then his conversation takes on a quite a magical quality. I guess the other aspect of in McLuhan's own work is he talks about everybody being in their medium. So he's talking about mediumship almost as as the normal everyday banal, if you will, that everybody's a medium all the time. And so this idea of conscious mediumship is this possibly a state out of or free from sort of the everyday hypnosis.
Okay, hold that. That's really good. The thought you started off was what?
Just dialogue, talking, and he discovers
he's
talking.
No, here's what it is. Your response you just gave, the very first part, right away points out what I say in my essay on McLuhan, that he went further than Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti was talking about a silent state almost, but McLuhan realized you could use language itself to be a – yeah, you didn't have to go into some mystical transcendent state of a trance or hypnosis, or even like Krishnamurti, get into a susceptible state, suggested state, suggestive state, and then talk. He definitely used words. It seemed to me that McLuhan was the next awareness, the next level. He did not get into romantic notions of what the heck it was to use language as a probe. What you just said is what I was trying to get at. Yeah, McLuhan went a little further, and then he juxtaposed his statement that imagination is that faculty not embedded in any senses or extensions of the senses. That's another statement. Think of imagination or mediumship as that faculty not embedded. And as a degree of your hypnosis, McLuhan could play with language. He could even play with the larger collective effects of television. Most people were trying to figure out their relationship to speech and either tried to avoid it by going into a transcendent idealistic trance state or just suppress it and maybe try to meditate or just do frenetic activity to suppress the chatter of the mind. It seemed to me McLuhan was no longer bugged by the chatter of the mind. You see, I mean, he could play with it. Does that help you?
Yeah, I guess, early days in the conversation, so a lot of stuff spills out without being necessarily connected. It's also in the idea of Manipian's signature, I think, in works. And like I've been contemplating that for quite some time, you know, in terms of, you know, how do this Manipian tradition sign their work? Is it a conscious inclusion, this, that, and the other thing? But it almost seems that there's this tradition of almost Western mysticism, for want of a different word, that as soon as you start writing and talking within this tradition, having labored in this background, your work naturally gets signed and marked in certain ways. And so there's almost this, what do you call it? It's almost like a consistent mystical background to that tradition of writing that McLuhan participates in.
You mean you...
The Menippean signature spills out. You can't help it.
Right, but you're saying that you end up being an echo of previous Menippean satires?
Yeah, totally. And so there's this the shadow of tapping into something which is bigger and deeper and broader than yourself.
That's right. Now, that's a good point, because I always puzzled whether Dave Worster and Christian Murder were naives, much the way you could sometimes take McLuhan's target when he criticized Gnosticism, mysticism, or nature mysticism. He was not, he didn't say he was part of that tradition. He was more embedded in the tradition of speech, but then had to deal with the apocalyptic annihilation of the Logos by, you know, electronic media. So he actually, when I adopted his view sometimes that he was right, that Worster and Christian Murray's got themselves all bottled up within the realm of speech and whether to tell anybody anything. They hadn't even got to the phatic level of speech or the anthropological discoveries of speech. And that was the... But then sometimes I flip back and say, McLuhan was lost in speech and never got into the transcendent. So I was ambivalent in bouncing around there. So if you adopt McLuhan's point that he was aware that language itself was the greatest medium, it was the medium, language, and all the cultural content in a race or language that went with it, so that when if you did a work and you tapped into a perceptive position resonating with the present, you would evoke all what Eliot called the auditory imagination, all the echoes going back to Homer and all subsequent works in there. You were channeling that. It was not some transcendent platonic zone that Krishnamurti and the mystics and mediums got to. You know what I mean? That's the argument. That's the question of where to lay the hypnosis or the larger suggestion or the larger unconscious. And McLuhan was careful to point out that the larger unconscious was not some mystical thing based in instinct like Freud or in Jung's super mystical collective unconscious. It was right in the tables and radios and telephones and atmosphere and chairs I'm sitting in that I was engaged in right now. That was our unconscious. That was the medium it tapped into. So you could say there's a materialist view of mediumship, and that would be Aristotelian, I guess, but embedded in the senses. And then there's a Platonic view of mediumship. That's maybe the dialogue there, right?
Yeah, and then there's something which is beyond both of those, I think. Because I've read a letter from McLuhan to Hugh Kenner, and I think it's back in 49, 50, 51 sort of period. And he's talking with Hugh about Bergson's theory of unconscious, I think it is. And he's talking about an eternity of, I guess, words and languages, where something never goes out of existence. And he's not completely denying that. He's just pointing at this funny little, I guess, what do you call it, the midden heap, the mountain of language, or this something, this entity which exists beyond and outside humans, in a sense. And so he's playing with those things back in 49-50, and then the theme kind of disappears, and at least overtly.
That's it. You're saying that he said McLuhan himself, he's telling Kenner that he understood the unconscious as a midden heap.
Yeah, well, no, he's far, he doesn't commit. He just points out that he points Kenner in the direction of Bergson's theory of, I think, it's the unconscious.
But you know that's you know that that's not going to be his whole point, because Wyndham Lewis, he would be also thinking of Lewis's criticism of Bergson.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's definitely not the whole point and definitely not the lockdown, but he's gesturing in the direction and saying, hey, look, there's something going on here. Let's you sort it out and lock it down, presumably in the role of teacher, you know, like whether he's actually got it sorted or not is a different story.
Yeah, now when you mentioned going beyond either tradition, it would seem that a medium, at least a modern medium like Dave Worster, if you put him in the Platonic tradition, he really, through his mediumship, was detached from it and critiqued it. And that detachment, the imagination not embedded in the archetypes of the Platonic unconscious, allowed him to be a medium, to play with it. And McLuhan would be detached from the Aristotelian thing. It's the detachment from either tradition that makes you a medium. You know, so that's right. If there's something beyond that, that would be the medium state. An expert in the Platonic archetypes are trying to point beyond it and coming up with a strange state of mind. And then McLuhan not doing the transcendent, but taking on the Aristotelian unconscious and being detached from that. So, and then he becomes a medium. Definitely, you can see where McLuhan and Zappa, his wife talked about this, they'd be discussing or writing about things, and it would show up in the culture somewhere. McLuhan wrote, I think the reason McLuhan attracted a lot of attention in the 60s is that many people were feeling the effects of the satellite environment, and they saw that McLuhan was expressing it, and McLuhan might have been surprised that so many different artists identified with his work and saw, and they saw their work in McLuhan. Somehow McLuhan was picking up on the imagination that was going on around that time, and he resonated with it. So he was the focal point, and therefore the you consider the channel of it, so that he could have what I feel I have, the Xenocrine experience. He had that. They waited. He knew. He would take these books home from the library every night, from St. Michael's Library, a big pile of books, and just scan them. He knew, just like that sentence in his essay on Joyce, around page 32 or 34 of The Interior Landscape, where he says, and he's speaking about himself, but he puts it on to Joyce. Joyce waited for the slips of tongue and other accents that he knew would be coming, that would give him clues to a larger ground. McLuhan knew that's what he was doing. He had full confidence and faith that he'd discover the materials he'd require to point to a larger ground. Did that make and that's a kind of sensitivity. You have people in the New Age trying to be mediums or channel some spirits. It's so ridiculous compared to how McLuhan could be a medium in a more subtle way and not be tagged with the stigma of being a psychic or something. You see what I mean? He found it. You can maybe the way to be is in the interval between the Platonic and Aristotelian tradition. When you're doing that, that would be the more appropriate response to the situation of the middle 20th century.
Yeah, yeah.
The point is, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. Like, if I don't know if we were talking, in our other talks, I guess we'd raise Cicero, and McLuhan will always say, "Oh, yeah, Cicero is neither Platonic nor Aristotelian. In a sense, he's something different." But like, this is kind of the flip side, the lesser explored side of it. And there is there is another dimension going on here. Hey, I found this letter from McLuhan to Hugh Kenner. It's on January 23, 1950. I'm sure there's something good in it. It goes, "Dear Hugh, Stein's Roots of Bergson's Philosophy, page 58 FF, excellent on origin rise of doctrines of the unconscious in 19th century, e.g. Guyan's Guyan, sorry, being a New Zealander, you get to never speak these things, whom consciousness as luminous points, small lens groupings, grouping pencils of light and imagining that its focus is that from which the rays diverge," blah, 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 goes on. is looking at consciousness as a spectator and condenser of psychic memory, and psychic memory in turn is cosmic because nothing that has been can cease to be, hence collective unconscious. Hence, Malarm's doctrine of poetry is incarnation, able to raise any kind of experience, simultaneity of all experience, etc. Consciousness discontinuous, but psychic memory continuous. It goes on from there. But it's then he talks about Bergson's matter and memory as being significant for Finnegan's Wake.
Okay, Andrew, you've been holding out. I've never heard that letter before. That's an extraordinary letter. How come, did you use that in your thesis?
I think a bit of it. How about this? The faculty of language cannot be localized anywhere but in the whole brain or whole body.
That's incredible. Actually, it's probably relevant for that letter to be put into a public meeting like this right now, because that's the most Gnostic talk, or using the word cosmic and memory. That's totally relates to what I've been talking about with Worcester and Krishnamurti. Now, that letter is what you've been thinking about as you thought about conscious mediumship?
It's been bubbling away for some time. I really am groping. I'm not kind of sure what the questions I'm kind of asking, but I've got a whole lot of bits that that I'm working on putting together. So, yeah, that's one of the bits and pieces that...
Well, I've never heard that letter before. You got that through the Kenner Archives?
Yes.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary letter. That's like new information and confirms my suspicions. Because I used to talk to Don Thiel about, McLuhan's interested in Gnosticism, and Don would point out, look, he uses the word cosmic in 1955, maybe Five Sovereign Fingers, Tax of Breath, one of those kind of articles. Man moving to a cosmic plane. Now, Thiel knew that cosmic became a popular word in the 60s and 70s and was associated with the Aquarians and the New Age. But I knew that Don was struck by such a flaky word used before its general popularity, but it was risky for McLuhan to use that. But you got him using the word cosmic right there in that note to Kenner. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, in 1950.
Right, and what's interesting, he's evoking the tradition that Bergson represented and was the opposite of Lewis's interest. And it shows McLuhan, quadriphenic McLuhan, he can go into Platonism and he can go into Gnosticism and Aristotelianism and all over the place, because him putting on that kind of talk about Bergson is heretical if Lewis knew he was saying that, so to speak, engage Bergson.
There's a bit of distance in it, though, because he's saying excellent on the origin and rise of the doctrines of the unconscious in the 19th century. So in a certain sense, he is just studying the effects as well. He's sort of going, oh, look, Kenner, here's another bit of inventory. It's pointing to some pretty interesting stuff, but it's not the whole of the matter. So I think you can sort of see some degree of detachment from it, even in this early, back in the 50s.
It's not necessarily early. I agree with you exactly that he knows that's the literate version of the unconscious, and he's tracking the diluted interpretation of the unconscious as an effect of literacy that only he sees as an effect, because he sees the unconscious is not in that mystical realm. But the point is, he knows he has to think about that meme in relation to what he thinks the unconscious is. You know what I mean? It's like Barry Neville used to say, Marshall did not read enough Marx, Karl Marx, and so, he should know more about it. And so Barry Neville said he himself was the guy who knew enough about Marx to make Take Today a valid book. And he put all the Marxian stuff in there, or the critique of Marx that McLuhan wouldn't have come up with. But it's the same thing. McLuhan here, he knows at least about the history of the visually biased mystical version of the unconscious. You know, he's well-versed in that. Maybe Baron Everett wasn't, but he's well-versed in that. And he knows his enemy, so to speak. And he's showing that there. But before, I wanted to show you, Mark Stallman wrote to me. He said, my question was, what did you read from Hilaire Belloc? What did you say about what you read? And to amplify, did you study him as hard as you have Joyce? Now, I want to give my answer to Mark, to you, because this is what I'm talking about. I said, and I would say that this is what McLuhan would say, though I don't know, but, you know, this is what I think McLuhan would say. I haven't studied anyone. I dabble, looking for the ground in quotes, looking for the ground outside the authors. It comes naturally to me. When I engaged the Finnegan's Wake Society of New York, I studied the members' response to Joyce, skirted over the reading/content, and pissed off those who intuited what I was doing. I did this in Mark's nonlinear circle also. As Robert Fulford accused me, as Robert Fulford, a famous mainstream Canadian critic, as Robert Fulford accused McLuhan of being, I'm an Eskimo. If you notice, I only quote a few obscure Finnegan's Wake quotations in every interview I do. Doing so much Ion, I can hardly remember the Joyce Thompson, LaRouche, Croker, or McLuhan stuff. I don't remember anything about.
That's beautiful. Sorry to interrupt, Paul.
Well, I appreciate your enjoyment. And I said, I don't remember anything about Hilaire Belloc. See, he was one if anybody had written anything on him. And I said, I did, or at least talked about it. Then he wanted some particulars, and I'm basically saying, I can't remember what I wrote back then, which reminds me, and I always like having these talks within the McLuhan zone with a McLuhan scholar, because it reminds me of the other great McLuhan scholars. And Joe Keogh was a great McLuhan scholar. He edited, he did the annotations for the index in Gutenberg Galaxy. Mary McLuhan, I think it was, told me once that she was sick of Joe Keogh. He used to always be coming around the house, hanging around his father, and, you know, he'd be there around the house. So that's her memory. But that shows us how much Joe was around McLuhan. He was bugging the daughters by his presence. But anyways, that's the late Joe Keogh. And but Joe Keogh would, we'd be talking, he'd say something, and I'd say, what did you say? You know, he'd say something obviously pretty interesting. I'd ask him to repeat it because I didn't get it. He'd go, I never repeat myself, Bob. He refused to repeat what he said. So he was aborting any conversation. Then he'd come up with something else, and if he didn't get it, he wouldn't repeat it. I thought that was pretty McLuhan-esque, even though maybe McLuhan would repeat. But you get my point? That's pretty interesting. That's what he got from McLuhan. He would just say stuff and never bother making sure you got it.
Okay, so that raises an interesting point. I think it's in the conversation with Dave Worster. I may have that wrong, where Dave is talking about how Krishnamurti frequently... Was it Dave? Krishnamurti asked him to...
Or Robert Carr. Might have been... Yeah, Robert Carr was the one who spent a lot of time with Krishnamurti. Worster didn't have any personal...
It might have been Bob Carr. Sorry, it was Robert Carr. And it was asked to repeat something by Krishnamurti, and he did. And then Krishnamurti came back and said, good, on the idea that if you were in the state of conscious mediumship, you would be able to more or less perfectly replicate what you just said before.
Did he use the phrase? He didn't use the phrase conscious mediumship, did he?
No, but it was implied that he was awake, he was present, he was, in that sort of sense, how would you say, conscious at least.
Right, you're saying Krishnamurti, you say Krishnamurti said something, Bob Carr repeated it back to Krishnamurti?
No. The situation was Bob, I think it's either Bob Carr or I've got the funny feeling it was Dave Worster, was saying something, and then Krishnamurti said, you know, can you repeat that? You know, maybe he missed that, or maybe he was playing some game, he had missed that phrase or something, and the figure was able to repeat that almost verbatim, or at least the spirit was preserved. And then Bob Carr said Krishnamurti congratulated him then on account of being awake, being able to recall, being conscious, presumably it being a test of a true kind of interface with this mediumship.
Yeah, and I know there's two aspects to this. I mean, back in 1977, I remember I was on Venice Beach, Santa Monica Beach with Dave Worster at a party up in the veranda of a summer cabin or a cottage right on the beach. And we were talking, and he suddenly said, and I had said something, and then he says, "Can you repeat that?" And I said it exactly. I repeated it. And he says, "Good. Now I know you're aware that you're here." You know, he did the same thing that you seem to be saying. He wanted to see if I could repeat it, just see if I could repeat what I just said or whatever I was talking about, and how precise I could replay it, and the precision of the repeat of it impressed Dave that I was aware of myself. It was an interesting little test. That's what I'm reminded of when you talk about Krishnamurti testing how much Robert Carr was aware of what he had just said.
Yeah.
Either by Krishnamurti.
Yeah, so it raises an interesting thing, you know, as in trying to sync up to, you know, we've got McLuhan possibly pointing, practicing, and talking in this tradition versus Worster, Carr, Krishnamurti, you know, trying to sync up different people's articulations of what being in the state is all about. So maybe prove to be relevant, maybe irrelevant. Who knows?
No, it's very relevant to the letter. Let's go now back and read the letter to Kenner, because the word memory is in there in cosmic. I think the letter, read it slowly, get ready for me to interrupt at any point, and let's just go to the beginning and see what the words evoke, because it's good.
Okay, so first of all, so it's a letter from McLuhan to Hugh Kenner on January the 23rd, 1950. Please note that it won't be a verbatim recording. It's my retyping of a handwritten letter, so there may be some minor errors in it. Starts off, "Dear Hugh," and then it goes, "Shah/Stein."
So that means Gertrude Stein?
No. The guy's a famous sort of art philosophy kind of cricket critic. If we could just, we could punch him into Wiki and we'll get it.
Sheriff Stein is his name? Sharp Stein?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one person, Mr. Stein, Sheriff Stein.
That is correct. One second. Ben Ami Schaffstein. Ben Ami.
I don't know that.
Schaffstein.
Okay, so what's he say? What's he say about him?
Okay, Schaffstein, Roots of Bergson's Philosophy, page 58 FF, excellent on origin and rise of doctrines of the unconscious in 19th century, e.g., Guyans, whom consciousness as luminous point, small lens, grouping pencils of light, and imagining that its focus is that from which the rays diverge.
Okay, let's stop there. The other comment on mystical literature by McLuhan around that time, late 40s, is on the famous writer on Gurdjieff's works, P.D. Uspensky.
Yep.
And his book in Search of the Miraculous came out, I think, in the 40s or something. And Don Thiel remembered he and McLuhan talking about it. And McLuhan says in some literary criticism, he says, "Uspensky shows the plane becoming numinous."
Yep.
It was transcendent. So what I get here, the plane, and now you're getting the points. These are visual space, points and lines and planes that the phonetic alphabet through the printing press was created. But you're getting into the era of the telegraph. So you have the archetypalization or transcending or transcendent metaphor applied to points or Newtonian billiard balls, you know, points and planes. I'm taking there that visual space becomes this mystical, transcendent, infused, radiating environment as it's a supernova phase where it's literally going out as ground and it becomes infused with platonic significance. That's what I get from what you just read, that he's taking that quote, and I'm assuming he never said that. He's quoting somebody saying that, and he's pointing out that's an effect of the telegraph. He doesn't say that to Hugh, but that's the way, like I just said to Mark Stallman, he's taking a quote, a trend, a meme, to show a ground, but he doesn't say what the ground is. Anyway, that's what I say to that part. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I'll go and follow that one up. I'll go and check out this artist whom he's talking about and get into. I got some other works of Amy Schaffstein Ben Ami Schaffstein, but like, it's, you know, he's referring it to here, and it's like a paragraph. It's a tiny little paragraph, and it's kind of, it would take a whole stack of reading to follow it up. But so, no, I don't have anything to say, but I'll go and chase it and come back with something. You ready for the next paragraph?
Yeah.
Especially interesting, the work of Ribot. Is that Ribot? R-I-B-O-T? Let's call him Ribot.
Ribot.
Yeah. Who had a direct influence on Bergson, Hume, Pound. Consciousness as a spectator and condenser of psychic memory.
Okay. To me, those are definite descriptions of the features of a Gutenberg psyche.
Yeah, completely.
You say the first phrase. Say the first part again.
So
first phrase.
Especially interesting the work of Ribot, who had a direct influence on Bergson, Hume, Pound. Consciousness as spectator and condenser of psychic memory.
Yeah, now that's the detached state that the printed book brings in. That's pretty obvious, right? Consciousness as spectator. You know the McLuhan, unless McLuhan as a closet bookman was actually advocating a detached literate response to all that's going on, but a very sophisticated. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that the content refers to the literate bias, but when McLuhan was the writer using books as an anti-environment, he might have been trying to write them from that name, that position of consciousness, the spectator of what's happening.
Yeah,
though he would say that there were no spectator position possible.
Yeah, how is it? The consciousness as spectator, and so it's I'm awake, but I'm looking, but I'm able to condense psychic memory based on that line there. So, I mean, that's almost an expression of conscious mediumship, isn't it? Consciousness.
Okay. Let me say this first. To condense psychic memory is the literate project. It reduces meanings to, you know, the chaosmos of acoustic and tactile man. It's reduced to linear things to remember. You know, it's the old Platonic Socrates quote, you know, the gods, was it Thoth, was warned by the king or something that he would induce forgetfulness. And the streamlining of acoustic resonance by condensed psychic memory, to me, is a literate effect. Now, okay, that's one way to look at it. Now, condensed psychic memory.
Yeah, we need this. We need the next sentence here, because it goes psychic memory in turn is cosmic because nothing that has been can cease to be. And that was in quote marks. So consciousness as spectator and condenser of psychic memory, full stop. Psychic memory in turn is cosmic because nothing that has been can cease to be. Hence collective unconscious. Hence Mallarmé's doctrine of poetry as incarnation, able to raise any
kind of experience. Wait a minute. Where do the quotation marks stop?
The quotation marks stop at the end of cease to be. So psychic memory in turn is cosmic because, quotation, nothing that has been can cease to be, close quotation.
That to me is McLuhan quoting the literate mind. He's referring to someone who's cosmic, and that's familiar. That's familiar New Age stuff, at least from Krishnamurti, Worcester, and even Ion. I see that's something that McLuhan would be critiquing. You know, I thought when you first read the letter, he was saying that, but he's not. He's quoting somebody, but he's noticing how the word cosmic is used. So, yes, if that seems, you know, conscious mediumship as done by channels and that, I say is the breakdown of the literate mind, but it's still trying to have the literate perspective. So in a limited sense, that is mediumship. You know what I mean? That could be a description of the trauma that the electric age does to the literate mind, and it starts falling into some schizoid split space. So if literacy created the psyche, the psyche becomes an expression of that split in the mind via channeling. So the channeling is in the traditional New Age sense, is the actual acting out of the effect of the phonetic alphabet, you know, in Greek times, 500 B.C., the creating of the individual soul. The Croker writes this about Augustine, locks this down. Well, Augustine condenses the third term, which is a resolution of the classical antinomies and classical unresolvable dialectic, the existential contradictions that literacy brought in, and it gets resolved by Augustine into the idea of a psyche, which then becomes the soul. And that's, to me, the condensed psychic memory. That's the soul. And in the telegraph era, when people started to have mediums and seances, that was the cracking of Augustine's third term, or the creation, the centralizing, transcendent of the classical argument, abstracted into a visual point, the condensed psychic memory. That is what's broken down, and McLuhan is taking a quote of someone unaware of that, but is discussing intelligently the condensed psychic literate soul, and he's going to bounce off that to point at a larger ground. Okay, let's see. At the end of the quote, I think he does what I'm saying. The next words, which are by McLuhan, he goes to Mallarmé, one of the first guys to use words as a probe, or even use literacy as a probe, not to find and maintain some transcendent monadic unity. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's hear that part in light of what I said.
After that quote, it goes, hence collective unconsciousness, hence Mallarmé's doctrine of poetry as incarnation, able to raise any kind of experience. Simultaneity.
Oh, hold on. No, that's the point, is Krishnamurti is saying, my speech will activate you. You don't need to go into any abstract schizoid state of mediumship. My speech will evoke you. Now, McLuhan is saying that Mallarmé discovered that and played it. So Mallarmé is the first conscious medium with speech. And then McLuhan goes on to point out why Mallarmé was able to discover that, because the electric environment killed speech. And all that speech could be under telegraph conditions was incantation, the very things that you have there, he says, Mallarmé is doing. And the delusion of a unified consciousness, the collective unconsciousness, which is really just the meme of the Gutenberg galaxy, which was going to be broken up into multi-consciousness by the electric technology. You get me what I'm saying?
Yeah, so did you get poetry as incarnation? Or you're not hearing my funny New Zealand accent,
no,
as incantation? So
it can be either incantation. No, if it's incantation or incarnation, the same thing. You're using words to evoke memories or evoke the experience of the race, whereas other people write encyclopedias and try the dictionary. The guys who write the dictionary try to show the meanings of the words, not knowing that the words evoke their meanings regardless of what they meant or what the literacy guy gives.
Uh-huh.
That's Mallarmé's point. So
okay.
That's incantation and incarnation.
Okay, and so the rest of the thing goes, simultaneity of all experience, etc. Consciousness discontinuous, but psychic memory continuous.
Yeah, see? Consciousness is discontinuous. That's closer to the present and the electric age. The unconscious made by literacy is continuous. It's connected space.
Mm.
And, you know, I think that represents – it's good that it's on record, because I think he will not talk about that kind of stuff once he's got Innes to play with in 50-51. And if he didn't have Innes, he'd end up arguing with those terms like Lewis did, but he could drop all that. But it's important to know that he was fully aware of the Gnostic tradition and even the poetic extension of it, what he calls the secret society stuff, which isn't that bad. It's just they were literate and old-fashioned. You need to know he knew that so that you don't get thrown off by him being a Catholic, a naive Catholic. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's. I guess that's where his English. This is very much associated with his work in English studies, and just how I guess fringy he was, or maybe that was English studies at the time. I mean, the in the letter before, he's asking Kenner to get him a book called The Harp of Aeolus, which is some sort of it's looking at myth and magic and what have you in I think 19th century literature. So
yeah, I mean, I see McLuhan is fully interested in the wacky New Age stuff. For whatever reason, it might have come from his Rosicrucian parents, right? He could have been infused with that language. He is surprisingly hip on that stuff. That meme that people who are in the New Age world don't recognize McLuhan at all. If they do, they might see he's a Catholic, and that throws him out. They don't know. He knows more of what they're studying than they do, and he's found a way to drop it or to place it as an old psychic archetype. That's what's really valuable about this quote. He's showing, see, I know that I thought through those things that way too. You almost inevitably get to thinking about the unconscious and what it is, and then realizing it's literate, and then you move out of that into the new silent seas of, we'll call it Harold Innes dynamics. That's where you have to go. That's where your thinking will go if you're a literate person. And so it's great to see McLuhan tracking the same stages that I was forced to go. Or it's almost like we walk through the Gutenberg galaxy as a zombie, and you're going to get all the same thoughts that everybody else gets from the literary corpus. And then you will come to, you know, the vortices and Lewis and Joyce to their questions. And then that opened. Then if you don't know, you're not lucky enough to find McLuhan, you're stuck there. You don't make the breakthrough. And these letters are to Kenner, are the stages you go through before you get to the McLuhan's front door. You know, that's whatever I'm saying, I just hope you understand what I'm saying. I'm not asking you to agree with it, but you get what I'm saying and what I mean, right?
No, I mean, I'm looking right at it. I mean, this is the last letter before McLuhan discovers Innes. So the next letter in chronological sequence is January 30, 1951. So it's almost a year later, but in this letter, a year later, he's talking about Gideon and he's talking about Harold Innes. And he's totally made the jump, and he says he's going to drop English and he's going to move into a whole different thing. So this is the end point
of literacy as far as he can go, and he catches up with the mystical concerns of Pound and Eliot at that point. You know, he knows that's where they got, and he does say Pound and Hume, a big influence on Eliot. But you said that's January 51. He has met Don Thiel. Thiel has given him one of the Norbert Wiener books, either Human Use of Human Beings or Cybernetics, the book before. He has given it to him, and that has influenced McLuhan greatly, the Norbert Wiener scene. And he writes that letter saying, these guys are where it's at, not the little small-mag literary clack.
You know what I mean? Yeah, totally.
So it's very interesting how Thiel – It was mystical in the way when McLuhan reached a cul-de-sac, something would show up that he almost deserved, and it would be serendipitous, that would help him get to the next stage, you know, the next breakthrough. So that change, Thiel was part of it, but Thiel doesn't get the change. He's just the messenger. It's McLuhan has built up such an awareness. He's ready to be pushed into the next phase because he's earned it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But how much would a bomb? So if you're thinking the faculty of language cannot be localized anywhere but the whole brain or whole body, and then you're reading about cybernetics and the extension of the humankind through this electronic network, how much of a bombshell that would have been? It would have been pretty wild.
Yeah. No, that's a really good when he says that language is not lodged in the skull or the brain. That's what, you know, the postmodernists call the logocentric bias. McLuhan takes on a New Age resonant view of the body, an Oriental, Far Eastern view of the body as this resonating spectrum field of meridians and chis and chakras and other points, shiatsu points. The whole body is consciousness. He's broken through from the mouth-oriented view of consciousness which is a product of the printing press. You know what I mean? Like, that statement is very valuable because it shows he has made the New Age insight, the consciousness, not stuck in my brain.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a common meme 40 years later in the New Age circuit, that to move your mind out of your head and put it into your toes. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Now he gets that, and then he's going to realize, wow, the very image of spreading my consciousness over my body and not keeping locked in the brain is actually what electricity does to the central nervous system. It flips it out of that holistic body. And that's the breakthrough there. He goes beyond that statement as due to whatever he picks up from Wiener and Innes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that statement shows it's the importance of that statement shows that he got to that last point of literate mysticism or breakthrough from literacy into acoustic resonating space. That those paragraphs show that one goes through that, and he did it. And that's what my chart means. The whole Thompson quadrant, 67 to 72, is people resonating with that image that you just quoted from McLuhan as a collective effect of the computer. So if that – I don't want to confuse the issue bringing my chart in, but I'm just going to put it on the record. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, no. But this will clear it up. Like I haven't mentioned the sentence that was before that one.
Okay, let's go back to the whatever you did before and then lead into the next sentence.
Okay, so we just in that first paragraph where we've finished, consciousness is discontinuous, but psychic memory continuous. Full stop. Down.
Yeah, now do you agree with me? You agree with me that shows, you know, consciousness is a literary artifact if it's continuous. Unless McLuhan is a mystic and sees consciousness as the citadel of consciousness, something that is not affected by media. See, you know what I mean? There's that part of McLuhan where he believes he's a Platonist almost, that there's some part of human consciousness that's not affected by media. You know that's implied in Counterblast by his statement, correct?
Yeah, there's multiple ways of taking and reading that. I'd have to go and figure out like what kind of idiom he's talking in there. Like another way of saying it's consciousness discontinuous, i.e. people can die, but psychic memory, your soul, is continuous. Your soul can live on. You have an eternal spirit. So there's that element of what he's talking to.
I had not seen that.
Your consciousness, you go to sleep, wake up. Yeah, there's those sort of things as well.
Okay, Andrew, I did not see it that way. So read, what's the statement before consciousness is continuous? What's the line before that?
So especially interesting in the work of Ribot, who had a direct influence on Bergson, Hume, Pound. Consciousness as spectator and condenser of psychic memory. Psychic memory, in turn, is cosmic because nothing that has been can cease to be. That was the bit in quotes. Hence, collective unconscious. Hence, Mallarmé's doctrine of poetry is incarnation, able to raise any kind of experience, simultaneity of all experience, etc. Consciousness discontinuous, but psychic memory continuous.
Ah, okay. Consciousness is discontinuous and psychic memory, so memory becomes the bond, the cohesiveness as a ground. In the sentence before that, Mallarmé discovers consciousness as incarnation. What is it he discovered?
Hence, Mallarmé's doctrine of poetry as incarnation.
Yeah, and then the next words?
Able to raise any kind of experience. Simultaneity.
Okay, that's
all
memory.
Experience.
Okay, yeah. Andrew, able to raise memory, that is what he says. Psychic memory is continuous. He's implying acoustic space, simultaneity, consciousness. What is it? Something. I wish I could see the letter so it wouldn't be so scattered. But something raises memory.
Yeah,
I don't know. You're gonna have to read it again.
No. We can get around to this. We can take advantage of the fact that we're on Skype. And 1 second, I'll just.
Oh, yeah.
I can actually send you stuff like now. Here we go. Hey, Bob, your machine's going to...
Yeah, how do I pop that part where I see? I never, that know, under
did something chat? Just go doodle-doodle-doodle or make some similar kind of noise?
Yeah, it's okay, there it is. Good. All right. Wow. Now, you know, it's Shar-Stein. Is that, you say that's one person?
Yeah, it's Amy Ben Schaffstein or Schaffstein. This is just McLuhan's funny idiom that he's using.
Okay, good. All right, this is better. Excellent on Origin and Rise of Doctrines of the Unconscious, 19th Century. Goyen's Whom Consciousness as Luminous Point, Small Lens, Grouping Pixels of Light, and Imagining that its focus is that from which the rays diverge.
Yeah, I just also love it that an English professor is just writing in this super cryptic, very simple, blunt, not grammatically correct manner. He just writes text messages to Hugh Kenner.
Especially interesting, the work of Rebo, who had a direct influence on Bergson, Hume, Pound. Consciousness is spectator and condenser of psychic memory. Psychic memory, in turn, is cosmic because, quote, nothing has that has been can cease to be. So see, that mystical statement, and nothing has that has been can cease to be, Marshall sees as a natural effect of speech. You know, it's not something platonically transcendent. Hence, collective unconscious. Now, that could mean the concept of collective unconscious is a misnomer for what McLuhan says as speech. And then, hence, Mallarmé's doctrine of poetry's incarnation is an anti-environment to the idea of the mystical idea of the collective unconscious. It's right there in speech. You know, it's not some transcendent thing like Jung gets into. Able to raise any kind of speech, poetry evokes. I mean, language evokes everything. Simultaneity of all experience. That's the Eliot's auditory imagination. Consciousness discontinuous, but psychic memory continuous. Now, you'd have to ask McLuhan. Now, before I say anything, all this stuff, McLuhan told me that this period, late 40s, early 50s, he said it was rather a confused writing. And it is confused because he doesn't have Innes's language. And Innes's helps him get out of this, you know, literary bind he's getting in. He drops these concepts, so to speak. But the point is, you have to know that he was including them in the literate effect. So
the next paragraph, like that I didn't read before, that we'll just look at now, is possibly points to.
Okay, yes. Now, look, aphasia, what he ends up in his life experiencing. Okay, before we get that, he says consciousness discontinuous, but psychic memory continuous. Now, that can mean anything. Mm-hmm. You know, if we project that psychic memory is the citadel of consciousness, that is what's continuous, psychic memory or consciousness. You know, discontinuous isn't necessarily a bad meaning. It could be good. And it could mean, like you say, going to sleep. It's impossible to determine what he means by this. It's just great to know that he includes these words in his thinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what's important. Like he had worked his way through these conundrums. Consciousness discontinuous, but psychic memory continuous. What do you think it means? You tell me what those six words mean.
Yeah, no, I'm of the opinion that I'd have to go and do a hell of a lot of work to talk about that. Like I'm not familiar with this book, Roots of Bergson's Philosophy. I've had a look at that reference, but it's in a whole argument that I have a difficulty getting my head around. It's they were still talking in alibis back then. You know, everybody's right. Talking around and about, and it's a highly charged political situation, and these people in English, they're at the heart of it all, and they've just shipped off all their people into the intelligence agencies and this, that, and the other thing. And so I'm still struggling with that phase.
Okay. The next line where it says Bergson's matter and memory, that's exactly what we have to think about here. What is matter?
Yep.
He's describing matter, and matter, I think, intuits is a literate artifact. And he's relating memory to it, and there's literate memory, and then there's acoustic memory. So it's very important. It's almost like the whole letter is a poetic composition disguised as ruminations and jottings, but he's almost talking technically here because the issue of what's matter and what's memory, he names in the next paragraph, is what one thinks about when you're looking at the first two paragraphs. what I'm trying to say, you know, matter is grouping pencils of light. We now know that that's the literate biased version of matter, which doesn't hold anymore. I mean, you've got string theory now, which is showing acoustic space. The resonance of acoustic space is the ground of matter, not pencils of light or luminous points. That's the old literate ground.
Yep.
And so then he's trying to figure out what memory is in relation to that. And Doctrine of Poetry's incarnation is definitely memory as matter through acoustic means, not to literate definitions of matter. Yep. So with that in mind, you go to the next paragraph. It is plain from page 67.
I was just going to say the next bit. Yeah, read the next bit because I think it's all there.
It is. Yeah, and it's very – this is an amazing letter because look what he says. It is plain from page 67 that you ought to look in Bergson's Matter and Memory for significance of aphasia in relation to fitting, and that's fucking unbelievable.
Yeah.
That is his own fucking fate.
Yeah, yeah, but it's page 69. He's staring down the barrel of the post-verbal situation in relation to the disambiguation of the body and the electric situation. So it's like shit, Bob. It's electricity. We're going post-verbal here.
Yeah, but here's the point. We know how he used page 69 as his archetypal symbolic. Talisman,
yeah.
you know that story.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
He always looks to page 69, the first page he looks to in any book. And I don't know if, I guess page 67 is up to Finnegan, and then page 69 is the irregularities of nature are more instructive than its regular ways. There's the discontinuity there. But page 69, that proves to me that he has, he is stating this poetically. It's a contrived letter. He's embedding his own symbolism. In other words, he's being a mystical Platonic symbolist here, and psychic reality has a resonance and strength to people when something someone says gets unfolded 40 years later. It's right here where he's talking about aphasia, and that's what does him in. It's almost like this is where he goes through the vanishing point. And he moves in 5051 to the impersonal McLuhan, the dead McLuhan, the transcendent McLuhan. The McLuhan is the human body as a probe. And that means is he's gone past his human body. His body becomes an art form. So he predicts that his own physical body will end with aphasia. And because of his understanding of Finney's Wake, it's almost a mystical Batani prediction of his own fate as far as his mystical his physical body. But he's going to move to what I would call the TV landscape, which would later become the TV body. And there's no McLuhan there. So this is the end of McLuhan, the person wondering what consciousness is. And in 1966, 67, he says, I have no theory of consciousness, after he's thinking about it like this in his last vestiges of literacy.
Yep, yep. We can go for that. I'm looking at page 69, Finnegan's Wake, right now, and there's a reference in here to Guyant, Bliant, which is very similar to Guyan, whom consciousness as luminous point. So he's offering a key to his own letter in that sense.
Yeah. What's on that page? Read a few more quotes.
I always struggle at reading a bit of Finnegan's Wake. So Finnegan's Wake, page 69, is part one, episode three, page 69. Here we go. Not has been the expression direct or through an agent male of womankind offended. Ah-ha-ha. It goes blah, blah, blah on this, that, and the other. Now, by memory inspired, turn wheel again to the hole of the wall where Guyant Bliant fronts Peninlunimor. There was once upon a wall and a hoog-hoog wall was, and such wall hole did exist. Oh, there's Andy Warhol. Interesting. Seems to be offering an exegesis in his letter of this particular page.
Yeah, what you just read does echo with this statement, the irregularities of nature are more instructive than its regular ways. Now, listen to this. That's exactly the doctrine of Ion, that as you ascend, you will notice anomalies, the irregularities of nature more and more. And the more you recognize that it's not an issue that there are anomalies, whereas the scientific literate mind tries to put order to the anomalies, the order would be regularized. This is quite an amazing statement. And so,
particularly since McLuhan gets pegged as being a grammarian, as being on the side of the analogists.
You're saying this is not analogous.
Yeah, well, the analogist is that the similarities are more significant, as opposed to the anomalists.
Right.
And so here we him flipping and playing off the other side, or at least finding services in the an anomalous position.
That's right. I forgot. I was thinking about the anomalous position the other day, but I forgot it in this moment. But you're right. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, he's aware of the anomalous, and yet that's considered those are dialecticians who are concerned about the anomalies. They get all screwed up about the anomalous. So he's still aligning with the symbolists when he's pointing out that anomalies are no problem. The dialectician has a problem with anomalies. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
They actually get uptight about them. So he's stating the anomalous point of view here. Now, maybe I'm wrong to say the anomalous are looking for anomalous, are not trying to solve anomalies. I may be wrong in saying the dialecticians are trying to solve the anomalies. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, then you're right. But the point is that he is putting page 69, his symbolic page number. Page 67 could refer to 1967, which was his glorious year, 1967. That was the peak of his popularity and when he seemed to resonate with the pop culture the most. The irregular, but 69, 67 he's big, and 69 he starts to get suppressed, and he's out. But then there's his use of 69, what do you call it? The VAT 69 was his joke.
Yep.
And then you have the aphasia. The irregularities of nature are more instructive than its regular ways. Very loaded. So then what is – oh, then you get to page 70. The faculty of language cannot be localized anywhere but in the whole brain or whole body. And then he realizes that more than the faculty of language is localized all around us, because the post-verbal, as you said, is the new language. So these statements, the fact that realizing that language is not localized, taking on the new age paradigm of the post-literate, he drops all that. It's not even an issue when he recognizes that the new environments, the new electric environments, are the languages.
Yeah.
How's
the interplay there? The faculty of language cannot be localized anywhere but in the whole brain or the whole body. So he's not even committing. So it's not the whole brain and the whole body. He's kind of sort of saying that, well, it's not the whole brain. It's neither the whole brain nor the whole body, but the whole brain and the whole body, and somewhere that's in between the two. So he's definitely.
I got the answer for that. He says language is tactile. This proves what he means by language being tactile. It's in between the brain and the body. It's in between the holes. It's in the interval. It's tactile. That's what he means by tactility, what he says here, when he's talking about logocentric language.
Yep.
Oh, this is an incredible document. A lot in here worthy of what we're doing with it. the ironies, the mystical ironies, which would be the road of coincidence becoming archetypally significant. He says in cliche archetype that, narrative is created for novels and stories in the book culture because coincidence is made a big deal. The coincidence becomes a road of connections. You know what I mean? Whereas the pre-literate sensibility might see coincidence but doesn't cohere. Does not, what's that phrase above? Reduce. Where's that? Where's the reduction sentence? Condenser of psychic memory. The symbolist, the medieval symbolist sensibility, seeing references made by objects in the environment every object is resonant with significance, but not united under a literate headline. They're just allowed to resonate as coinciding, rather than the coinciding made into the linear root. I was talking about this on the Kurt Weller conversation last Monday. Anyways, do you see what I'm intuiting here about the juxtaposition of it? I think it's more like metonymy versus metaphor in the postmodern language. Metaphor is linked, whereas metonymy is resonating. Parallels, but no connections, yep. So to speak. That's preliterate sensibility. Not sure why I went into that, I know why. So the level of mystical coincidence becoming a plot line into a dramatic conclusion is you would bring that apparatus to this sentence that the moment he leaves his physical body, and he can because he knows consciousness is not localized in the body, he can go into the corporate. He goes from HCE to Finn, or Leopold Bloom to HCE, depending on the relationship between Joyce's Ulysses and Finning's Wake. He goes into the impersonal, into the through the vanishing point, and there's no McLuhan in his writings from 1953 on. He's able to do that. And so the irony is he died then, and he calls it aphasia, and that's what we see causing McLuhan's death, or it's a coincident aspect of his death. When his chemical body leaves us, it is doing what he wrote about 30 years before, at the point he already left his physical body into the discarnate perception. See, that's what's mystical or coincidentally connected, and you might think there's an unconscious coherence here, all those literate terms. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've been talking a lot. We're going to let you talk. You lead now in relation to this stuff.
Yeah, and no, I'm happy with that, as Bob. It's I haven't really had a way of grabbing a hold of and integrating this material yet. It just falls under the category of those interesting bits in McLuhan that I haven't really dug into. So. You know, I've been appreciating your commentary. It's good.
Well, yeah, am I offering a model of a larger framework to put it in? Is it working?
No. As you say, blocking and merging, I always take everything you say with I'll go and weigh it up and spend some time with it and go and do some research and see how it works. But, yeah, I as it relates to McLuhan, yes, very valuable, as it sheds light on trying to understand better this notion of conscious mediumship. I'm not entirely sure yet.
Okay, so let's bring it into. Did you intend on bringing this article, this letter, into our conversation, or you just thought of it while we were talking?
Yeah, no, I just thought of it when we were talking, and I was just able to search for it in my computer and bring it up.
Well, it's really good because. Now, conscious mediumship, you can bring in the word conscious and then relate to mediumship, which is often thought of as unconscious. So you got conscious and unconsciousness. They're both explored here in this letter to Kenner, the unconscious in the 19th century, consciousness discontinuous, consciousness as spectator. Consciousness as spectator and condenser of psychic memory, that on the surface is a good definition of the position of conscious mediumship in the literate world, but it's not the position of conscious mediumship when you're in the electric age. McLuhan updated conscious mediumship. He changed it. It required a different way of hypnotizing people because people were being hypnotized differently than the literate phase.
Yep.
So if literacy made people live on the surface and have no sense of the resonating coincidence and juxtaposition of experience, then verbal trancing was an anti-environment to that surface life that literate people lived. When you get into the life of depth, neurotic, fetishizing depth in the electric age, the environment of that is not trancing, but using pointing out that everybody is a conscious medium, but it's the particular medium that, which is their bias. Yeah, it's their particular medium that they're expressing, which is their bias. The ability to see that is a very complex form of multi-conscious non-mediumship. So you go from being a conscious medium to a non-conscious, to a better perception of conscious non-mediumship as seen in others. So that's what I think when I put McLuhan as more perceptive than Krishnamurti. Now, I could also see the truth of Krishnamurti that McLuhan could not handle and just became a chatterbox making up word games because he couldn't handle the transcendent state that Krishnamurti was. You know, I can see that position. But I can see these two positions because I am what McLuhan said we are, not embedded in any culture or any hypnotic state today. Nobody is because there's too many technological unconsciousnesses flipping about that nobody actually can attach to any form of hypnosis.
Yep. Which is also a kind of hypnosis in a way.
Okay. It's talking to that hypnosis that leads to the complex art forms of Manipian Finnegan's Wake, Manipian McLuhan, and the Manipian Dobbs. You know what I mean? That's what we're pointing to. Quadrophenia, conscious quadrophenia. So conscious mediumship gets changed to conscious quadrophenia in my time. So mediumship, you know what? Mediumship in the literate sense is the breakdown of the condensed psychic memory caused by literacy in the alphabet, that whole St. Augustine thing I was laying out, that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more useful to point out how the environments are our unconscious than any abstract mystical state that you're trying to tap into as an essence, which was largely the concepts of Dave Worster and what came through cosmic awareness. Now, what's interesting is Ion agrees with me on that. Ion says he agrees with McLuhan that Ion says there's no unconscious, there's no consciousness, and if anything's a consciousness, it's your immediate environment. That's your unconscious. So I find Ion is updated, but curiously, it appears to be a medium, though it denies that it is an entity or anything in the traditional medium genre. Ion agrees with me that Ion is an event horizon, I don't know, but it's an event. Okay, so conscious mediumship, if you have the private skull, the private body, which literacy creates, breaks down, then people as working robots in the 20th century expressing as actors the bias of their particular environment or medium, everybody becomes a subatomic channel or conscious medium of their media or mythic stage that they're involved in. It's watching, it's noticing. See, McLuhan was pointing out what that person was channeling, what this person was channeling, and it wasn't some mystical Jungian archetype. It was the particular object they used and favored in their society.
Yes.
That was the clue. That was the signature. And the Manipian signature, to use your phrase, is the strategy of pointing out everybody else's particular material signature, which is their medium. So conscious mediumship is really an important esoteric condition to jump from to get to McLuhan's right in the middle of Main Street, pointing out the conscious mediumship all around him, particularized, specialized.
Yeah, it's to go back to your response to Max Delman, with regard to Belloc. Like, I do have a sense of I think Mark, in some respects, is right to point to Bloch in terms of McLuhan's thinking about these things, because he's quite clear in that, in terms of a, how would you call it, an early 20th century articulation of a Catholic sensibility, which is basically there is something transcendent in terms of this, what the mediums and the spiritualists are going and doing. So it's like Bloch is quite interesting. He says, yep, actually the spiritualists are, they do have one thing going for them, that once you cut everything back, there is something going on. There is a transcendent horizon. But he says for a Catholic, it's a no-go zone, essentially necromancy, talking to the dead, to the blessed dead, and other forms of magic are no-touch zones. So I think McLuhan is, you know, as a convert, is particularly conscious of that. Like he's very aware of this, what would you call it, transcendental horizon that his artists and his peers are playing and dabbling in. And I guess in some senses, yeah, it's a concern and issue that stayed with him his whole life, is what's over the horizon in that respect.
Well, that's why it's a good topic, conscious mediumship, because this letter shows that it was a concern back then, and it was always a concern, but less and less so later for this reason. Tom Wolfe and his narration through Stephanie's documentary on McLuhan, the second one, which is a collection of the excerpts used in the 1984 documentary. There's a later one with longer excerpts or something. I don't know. I don't think it's in the 1984 documentary. In my mind, it's a later commentary by Tom Wolfe. And he talks about McLuhan using the Catholic thinkers, Maritain and Bloch and Chesterton. The point is, you don't say Bloch is the main guy. The whole range of Catholic guys is what he's using.
Oh, for sure.
The important thing, yeah, the important thing is that he drops all those guys in 1551, and he comes across whole new problems for Catholicism that that nobody recognizes. Let's see, how do I say this? To be concerned about going into spiritualism and avoiding it or saying it's a dead end is not a concern of McLuhan, you know, the later McLuhan, because those are dynamics for the Gutenberg galaxy. That is the debate between the arts and the sciences, between the intuitive and the objective, between the subjective and the materialist. McLuhan recognizes, this is what's important, he recognizes that both the Catholics and the spiritualists break down under electric conditions. And this letter proves that he understands that they are both products of literacy. And when everybody becomes a medium based on its clothing, the person's clothing, that's a new, whole new level. That's why I don't welcome the wondering where McLuhan came from in literate sources. I agree with Gerald O'Grady and Eric McLuhan that nobody influenced McLuhan, especially when he got into later level and realized that he can get better figures for what's going on from the post-literate culture than he can from the literacy culture. That's why he was considered anti-book, because he said every one of you literate guys have no clue of what to look at today. You're still arguing over whether a Catholic should be interested in spiritualism or not. These are irrelevant issues when everybody becomes a spiritualist by nature of the particular medium they use. That is, it's an externalize the central nervous system, you also externalize psychic archetypes, which are represented by the medium of choice.
Yeah,
and that's the definition of.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you play with replay, everybody's engaging in a form of necromancy, you know, watching back some old Elvis movies or something. But okay, yeah. so in terms of like
good point. Oh, Necroman, very good point. Conscious quadrophenia is necromancy is your clothing.
Yeah, you don't want to say that one too loud in your gated community there, Bob.
Oh, no, no. They've all lost their jobs and disappeared. I'm the only one here now. I've got my windows open. I'm just bellowing it over to the empty compound. There's no more paranoia.
Excellent.
There's nobody here.
Okay, so conscious mediumship. We've got to a really simple definition here, like at least a leaping off point for going further. So when everybody is in their medium and is locked into the particular hypnosis of their whatever their extended
by, which becomes their pattern of consciousness, which they promptly forget, because McLuhan says amnesia is a necessary condition when the databanks know more about you than yourself.
Yep.
So they adopt, in other words, that's where they become amnesiac. That's the trancing. They take on their bias and become willingly amnesiac about their own medium they're using. And they spend their time looking at other people's media and criticizing them for their unconsciousness.
Yeah, totally. And so conscious mediumship is that, detachment or involvement in detachment with that state and ability to, be able to articulate the massage. So that's on a very basic level. But there's still something left. There's still something that's still bugging me is like when you the tweet ions tweet or et cetera, there's various other reaching into and tapping into something which is over and beyond the horizon of consciousness. So it's not consciousness in and of itself.
Okay, when you take that view, that moves you beyond thought, which is what Krishnamurti and Wurster are for, and even ion. The beyond, that's what I meant when I was saying McLuhan couldn't go to the beyond thought. Krishnamurti could, Wurster could, and McLuhan remained lost in thought, analyzing thought expressed through media metaphors. If there is a post-thought condition...
Or found
then,
in thought.
Then, yes, Krishnamurti... You know? Found?
Yeah,
found in thought?
Found insofar as... I think he died a contented man. Or at least a bounded and integral man.
Who, McLuhan?
Yeah, possibly suffering, but ultimately joyous. So in the sense, couldn't go beyond his... I don't know that we need to put a value judgment on it.
Didn't
go beyond.
Right, I would say that he died knowing that his work... was a retort to Krishnamurti, to the transcendent something beyond thought. Because what is beyond thought all around us is the android meme. Mm-hmm. See, he knew that whatever strategy posture you took about your own elevated state of mystical realization was obsolesced by the environment. And that was the real challenge. So he found a new way. If the old way was to say, buddy, you're still lost, just like the Zen challenge, you're still lost in thought. I forgot that experience down the road. I don't live in thought. That is what the logocentric man comes to as his ultimate point. That may be a desirable point, but McLuhan came up with a question. Well, maybe that strategy of going beyond thought is not the way to get to beyond thought anymore when you're surrounded by, the externalization of the android meme existence at the speed of thought. So the idea that you could get a position of safety, like remember the Gnostic secret societies, Platonism rises out of the world and gets a safe zone up there in the transcendent zone.
That sort of elitist detachment, or I guess. McLuhan also says Egyptian mentality in a sense.
Yeah. Now this is where Wurster and Krishnamurti become like McLuhan. They agree that the elitist form of mysticism doesn't work anymore. Definitely they're on the side of McLuhan. It's just, what do you do with that point? And I think they died knowing.
Yeah, exactly, Bob. What do you do with that point?
And I think McLuhan was just happy to be in the public record of saying, I knew what the question was. This is the question. None of you guys can beat it. The rest of you guys, like Wurster and Krishnamurti, are still in the verbal and you don't get as far as Joyce.
Yep.
That's why it's so important that you – the significance of aphasia, what does that mean? You can't speak. You can't read. You cannot register literate information or express it like the meaning of Finnegan's Wake. He's describing what Finnegan's Wake is.
Yeah, well, there's a breakdown.
At least for the,
it's, so there's, yeah. there's a, that fundamental disconnect, that the more instructive discontinuity in reality, life, and experience.
That's right. And I think that what's interesting, I find Ion does give a solution by making this unanswerable an environment to counter the Android meme. There's not one statement in Google that Ion can't counter or bring up something, knows everything about everything on the data level, the classified data level. So Ion seems to be an event that provides in any environment. And I get the credit for evoking Ion along with Carol and JW. And we were in the perfect position to do that because I was wrestling with the real fuckers, McLuhan versus Krishnamurti, on the deep level. That was the question to ponder. And you're just getting to there, or been working on it for a few years. You're into the area that flipped into Ion. But, you know, kudos to you to get to that question. And you're the first to say, we need to discuss conscious mediumship, what that phrase means. And we find, and you find this letter, which backs up a lot of what I'm saying. And this incredible thing about the significance of aphasia in relation to Finnegan. You know, what is aphasia? You can't speak. You can't read, right? What's the other thing? It's exactly what McLuhan, and people have noticed, well, I don't think they got it as articulately as I'm saying. They did think it was odd. This is what they usually say in the obituaries. It is ironic that a man who loved to speak,
yes,
loved to read, could not do it. But they don't point out that McLuhan didn't necessarily love to read or speak. He knew it was a post-phatic world, a post-information society. Finnegan's Wake expressed that. And he knew, he almost said, I will die of aphasia to show you that's the last state of the chemical body, and I know why the chemical body is consciously aphasic. You people are all aphasic and don't know it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the aphasic, he understood. It wasn't ironic he couldn't speak. He stopped speaking and writing in 1953.
Yeah, in a sense, there's a... Yeah, I've totally moved into a different mode of speaking, authoring, and uttering or
he moved into conscious. You know what? His particular bias as a conscious medium was he was a conscious aphasiac. He was a conscious. and this is what Douglas Copeland doesn't understand. I haven't even read Copeland's book. Andrew McLuhan, you know, Marshall's grandson, says it's the best book. The best biography you've read. Well, that's because they don't understand this sentence. This is, we got to fucking write this to Copeland, because I read only in McLean's magazine a section where it seems he makes out a lot of McLean's neurological disorders and peccadillos as the source of his originality, even to say that he was autistic. This is where Copeland is all wrong. When you see this statement, which is an incredible fucking punchline of the whole argument I've been presenting, to say the significance of aphasia and that he dies from that, that resonates with so much because he predicted his own fucking way his chemical body would die, even though his chemical body had died in 1952. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It had died with aphasia with Joyce. And it's matter and memory. What is McLuhan? His matter body dies. His memory lives on. His memory was embedded in his writings and in his recording. That's his memory. He puts the correct words in there and preserves consciousness discontinuous, or whatever you want to say, consciousness as spectator and condenser of psychic memory. That's what he actually did in his writings, his corpus, his oeuvre. You could write a whole, you know, volume on how this letter defines the range of issues and fates of McLuhan's own chemical body, as well as pointing to how he transcended it. So his books become the new form of consciousness. Because I asked Barry Nevitt at the end of, Take Today, I think it's page 297, it says, we now have the recently achieved forms of consciousness, to counter the 100 years of tribal unconscious. Mm-hmm. I asked Barry, what are the recently achieved forms of consciousness? Because he co-wrote the book. He said, Finning is Wake, which brings you back to this sentence here.
Yep. Okay.
The book, yep. Finnegan's Wake is the way to retrieve the simultaneity of experience, which is the legacy of literate man. It preserves, it embeds in memory the literate meme,
yep.
which McLuhan is not against. It retrieves consciousness as spectator, which is imagination. It's using visual services, the effect of visual space, it using its archetypal services. It has a service to have a book like Finding Its Wake as a way of looking at the hippity-hop culture all around you.
It preserves culture, dialogue, the possibility of dialogue. If you're conscious of a spectator, it maintains the necessary gap.
That's right, which leads to retrieves verbal consciousness.
Yeah.
It gives you something to talk about.
And some sort of sense of individuality, whatever that may be.
Right. Now, that's not – here's the point. That's not the ultimate condition to be in. To have a harmonious sensory life, you must have all the senses happening, and therefore you got to have all the extensions of the senses happening. And as they shrink, have all the bodies happening. And McLuhan preserves – he's the Noah Ark – of the visual sense, building on what Joyce did with Finding His Wake. He explains how the visual sense, so it can mingle and you can have the temporary transient experience of individual consciousness or detachment that is only preserved by a book like Finding His Wake. It's the only book necessary. Because it's so garbled, you can get any people together and they will be evoked into wonder and in dialogue about what the heck the words are referring to.
Yeah, totally.
It's the only way to get a discussion or retrieve verbal enjoyment. It's the only way to get it going through Finning His Wake. Otherwise, it's just someone lecturing you on what some point of view is, and that doesn't hold anybody's attention anymore.
Yeah.
You can see McLuhan's whole description of the effects of the solar theater, the global theater, are exhibited in Finning His Wake. So it contains, it even, as Don Thiel, you know, his genius pointed out, it even contains the replay of the global hologram with digital Android meme technology. It even includes emailia. That's a word in Finning His Wake, uh-huh. Emailia, E-M-A-I-L-I-A. So you actually, this letter definitely has to be put through the mill of dark matter or ear map. He must make a chart out of this or an icon. You know how he makes his
his
graphic. He'll love this.
No, it's great to go back to. Oh, please! It's nice to go back to what he does because it often sparks a fresh way of looking at something. So, I'd love to see what he does with it.
Yeah. So I'll take this letter and post it, and you know, make some ridiculous statement like, McLuhan channels ion or something.
Yeah, cool. January 23, 1950. That's the date of it.
That's a great date because you know what that is. That's,
1, 2, 3.
That's just after that. Yeah, but it's just after the important date, January 22nd. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, it's the end. See, that's the LaRouche quadrant, 23 or 7. The 23 guys are the mystics, the Jungians, and the scientists. That debate between the anomalous and the analogous ends in 1950, and LaRouche represents the one part of that debate. And
well, that's talking about that's the consciousness luminous point.
Yes, that's right. And LaRouche does a really good post-literate baton retrieval of the science meme so that he retrieves Platonism in a new way. It's a valiant effort to get beyond the literate bias. But the I'm saying this is January 23rd. McLuhan writes this on the 23rd because it's the 23 gang, and he's putting them away with their final thinkings. And so then he moved to January 22nd. That's the day I start setting up being in Flipside, but that's 122, the original 22. It's very appropriate this is the 23rd, you know, not the 22nd. This is the sweeping up and putting away of the 23 quadrant.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
I mean, this is the kind of stuff, let me just say this, this is the kind of stuff that convoluted and absorbed Robert Anton Wilson. Wilson remained stuck in this period, 1949-50.
Oh, at the level of his language, his thought, his themes, and his preoccupations?
That's right, his issues, his fetishes. He didn't get through the vanishing point. And that's why McLuhan did go through the vanishing point more than anybody, because he knew Joyce had done it. So to the degree that's important, as a knower, you know, it's almost like the literate consciousness has to escape, find a new way to escape. McLuhan found a new way to annihilate himself that was not the means that traditional secret societies used, either Platonic or Aristotelian, right?
Yeah, or found a new way to annihilate and not annihilate himself.
Right, a new place to be a spectator from.
Yes. Okay, so like picking up on your comments on Finnegan's Wake, is James Joyce a conscious medium?
Yes, and he actually dabbled, you know, in my Ion came through on March 18th. I didn't record that conversation, but I talked to McLuhan that, and McLuhan specifically identified himself. First thing he said was a comment about Mary, his daughter, and I am working with Mary, and he said a very personal thing about Mary only Mary and I would know. And I knew this was something close to McLuhan's consciousness because that was the first thing it said. And it knew if it said this, I'd be impressed. So anyways, it did McLuhan on March 18th. And then on March 20th, we had a six-hour session. And then on March 22nd, I had my third session. It was the second one recorded. I could play it for anybody. I talked to James Joyce about his writing of Finnegan's Wake for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. It was a long talk. And one of the interesting things that came out is that he spent a lot of time going to gypsies and, you know, traditional mediums. And his wife was scared shitless of the dead and mediumship and liked to think that Joyce was going to a brothel. She accepted him going to a brothel because that was better than thinking he was going to somebody and talking to the dead. That scared the shit out of her. So he did this because he was groping around trying to figure out what he was doing. And so he probably had to engage the discarnate, the astral sphere, to see what to do an anti environment to it, to retrieve the matter or something. So I bring that up as definitely he was involved and interested in mediumship, and one of the Joyce scholars talks about him exploring one particular medium. I only knew about that. But then I found out from Ion he was doing it a lot more. So he definitely was figuring out a way to do conscious mediumship and get to conscious quadrophenia. McLuhan spells out quadrophenia. That's the tetrad, which is the tetrad, I say, is a condenser of the chaos around you. You know, it's a simplification.
Yes.
But it's useful to give you a tool of handling the multi-conscious chaos so you have this simple. So the spectator as the tetrad as tool for spectatorhood and condenser of psychic memory. All these things can be applied to McLuhan's tetrad, and you can see the tetradic is implied in Finnegan's Wake. So definitely Joyce. Joyce is the an attempt at conscious mediumship post-Krishnamurti. I mean, McLuhan used Joyce to get past Krishnamurti and the tradition that Krishnamurti represented. Now, Dave Worster is not a pure Krishnamurtiite. He actually is – he read McLuhan. He thought about it. And recently, finally, J.W., the guy that goes into an altered state and allows Ion through, he had a long dialogue with – they met on the phone. And it was pretty interesting. The guy who started it in 68 – meets the completion in 2001, 2010, and Dave Worser had a very dramatic night. He did get some epiphanies about the whole interaction. So we're going to be offering that tape, not right now, but eventually. So the guy that I got the phrase conscious mediumship from, he had his own epiphany through ION. ION understands conscious, can talk about conscious mediumship and quadrophenia, uses the terms, and has a pretty good understanding of it if you've talked to ION as long as I have. And they come from two guys interested in the traditional psychic spiritualist world, McLuhan and Finney's Wake. It all works perfectly.
Okay. Well, I think it's probably a good place to almost call a wrap on this one, Bob. I would quite like them to be short enough so that people can listen to them. Like the 10-hour tailgates are a bit much for some humans. So
for the quadrophenics. But the quadrophenics amount of us is too much.
we'll start small and hopefully build up. So I'll just... are you happy to wrap it there? It just seems like a natural spot to pause it until next time we get an opportunity to talk.
Yeah, I hope you get a chance to either re-listen to this because it's not finished, this topic.
No, we're only just starting up. We're starting up.
Right, so you will get some echoes from what we're saying and blockings and mergings and disagreements and new thoughts. It'll be perfect. And congratulations for getting us into... a post-Ben Watson, post-Scott Woods, not necessarily post-Kurt Weller, because I'll be bringing this stuff up with Kurt Weller, when I do my next session with him. Kurt Weller is evoking interesting street talk for me to the degree that he's got Buzz Kosten making YouTubes again. Awesome. Not to knock Ben Watson or the Scott Woods. They're great dialogues. It's just that there's another angle we need to go at, and you've evoked it.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of those Scott Woods dialogues that are some of the best that you've done. I've fully enjoyed them. They've been spectacular.
Yeah, no, everybody I interact with all has great hits they evoke. They all have great hits, You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's all different aspects of
conscious aphasia, which is it. it's interesting. I did say to Mark Stallman, I can't remember anything. I actually announced conscious aphasia in that letter. I'm going to call that when I post this. Conscious aphasia refutes. McLuhan refutes Douglas Copeland from the grave, or from his own divine archive. Now, as I'm talking to you, I get a post comes in from Buzz Kosten with the latest Dobbs YouTube, which is probably evoking. It's called Yukio Iono, making a pun on Yoko Ono, and future dash modern post-Manipian satire. I like that. Don't know what it is, but that's his latest YouTube. It's an immediate response from Buzz to what we've done, even though he hasn't heard it yet.
Yeah, no, we'll see. I'll have a look at that one with interest and see what his commentary is.
Okay, I'll forward it to you.
Cool.
Well, very good, Andrew.
Thanks, Bob. Excellent. I'll push stop now, and then I'll just keep talking briefly. So I'm just...
Okay.